From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell rejected calls from Democrats for witnesses to testify as part of an eventual impeachment trial in the Senate. On the Senate floor today, McConnell criticized Minority Leader Chuck Schumer for suggesting it.
The Senate is meant to act as judge and jury, to hear a trial, not to rerun the entire fact-finding investigation because angry partisans rushed sloppily through it.
Meanwhile, the House Rules Committee sets terms today for the impeachment debate to come tomorrow in the full House, where all members will vote. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing joins us from Washington with more on this. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Chuck Schumer responded to Mitch McConnell today, pointing out that McConnell said he was coordinating with the White House regarding setting up the trial, which many Democrats say is inappropriate, given that the president will be the defendant in this trial. But what does all this tell you about what the Senate trial will look like?
Well, it tells us that the shoe is going to be on the other foot here. Republicans are in the minority in the House, and so you've heard them complain about the process, how it's unfair, how the evidence is incomplete, how the president is getting what critics have called a railroad job. But Democrats are the minority in the Senate, which means they're going to be using a lot of those same arguments because they have less control over the process there. And that's been this dispute between Schumer, the minority leader, and McConnell, the majority leader. McConnell controls the votes. He controls the chamber, and he decides the terms on which this is going to happen. That's the nature of this disagreement that you were just talking about.
Now, in the House, there is going to be debate tomorrow ahead of a vote that could come later tomorrow. More vulnerable Democrats have announced that they plan to vote for impeachment, even though it may cost them their seats in right-of-center districts. How have they weighed that risk?
Well, what a lot of them are telling constituents at home and announcing publicly is that they believe this is, in fact, as you've heard the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi describe it, a test for the House itself, for the Congress more broadly, she argues, about whether it's going to agree to allow or go along with conduct as uncovered in the Ukraine affair. Democrats say that the concessions that President Trump expected from Ukraine's president this year are inappropriate, they're an abuse of power, and that by trying to get the president of Ukraine to do investigations that Trump thought would help him in 2020, that he's gone beyond the pale and the House has no choice but to act. These Democrats you're talking about may be taking a risk. They may be taking a somewhat courageous move in these terms by going against the views of some of their constituents. The question is, will it in fact cost them next year? That's one of the big questions that has been raised by this impeachment process, but which we can't yet answer.
There's also news I want to ask you about from Rudy Giuliani, who is a crucial figure in the Ukraine situation. Giuliani is now acknowledging that he pushed out the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. Here's how he put it on Fox News last night.
There's no question that she was acting corruptly in that position and had to be removed. She should have been fired if the State Department weren't part of the deep state.
Phil, what is the significance of Giuliani saying this now, and why is he saying it now?
That's a great question. Why is Giuliani speaking out? I think that only he could probably address that. But the reason it's significant is, for one thing, he's tying the president in these comments on Fox and also in interviews with The New Yorker magazine and The New York Times. He's tying the president to the actions that he took. In other words, it's going to be much more difficult for the president, theoretically, to say that Giuliani is a loose cannon, that he's been acting on his own and the president had no knowledge of what was taking place. According to Giuliani, the president did have knowledge. He was being briefed by Giuliani and others as part of this early stage of the Ukraine affair. It's also significant because it confirms a lot of what Democrats have said are the facts of the case at the earliest stage here, that Giuliani and his advisors wanted to, in the eyes of the president's critics, set up a scheme so that they could get these concessions from the Ukrainian government. Masha Yovanovitch, then the ambassador in Kyiv, was going to stand in their way, so they had to get her out of that job. What Giuliani is saying is basically that's why she had to go, and now we have it from his own mouth on TV and in these interviews that he's done with the press.
It's interesting. As this process moved forward and an historic vote probably tomorrow in the House, new information continues to come out. That is NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as we heard there, most vulnerable Democrats in the House will vote for impeachment. One Democrat, though, New Jersey Congressman Jeff Van Drew, has decided to switch parties ahead of tomorrow's vote. National Republicans welcomed the defection, but back in Van Drew's South Jersey district, voters are rethinking their loyalty to a man they've supported for nearly 30 years. WHYY's Nick Pugliese reports from Van Drew's hometown of Dennis Township.
A dentist by trade, Jeff Van Drew rose from a small-town mayor to state lawmaker before his election to Congress last year. It seems like everyone at a Wawa convenience store here can recount a personal interaction with the congressman.
You know, I could go to the grocery store on any Saturday, and he'd be out front asking people what they thought and what they wanted.
Perry Tell, a Democratic-leaning voter, says Van Drew's energy and involvement translated into bipartisan support in a district that voted for Trump by 5 points in 2016.
And I always felt that he was fair-minded and, you know, he stood up for what the people wanted here.
But reports over the weekend that Van Drew was changing political parties sent shockwaves through New Jersey politics and prompted the resignation of 7 of his congressional staffers. Van Drew has faced increasing isolation within the Democratic Party for voting against an impeachment inquiry into President Trump last month. He says the process is too divisive and has little chance of succeeding in the Senate. Tell says it's one thing to vote against impeachment and another to join a party she says supports white racism and denies climate change.
To flip yourself over to those guys is just a big betrayal to me when I've supported him all his life.
Republican leaders, including President Trump, reportedly courted Van Drew as internal polling showed his popularity among Democrats slipping. Facing dim prospects for winning a primary election next year, Van Drew is now putting relationships with his longtime supporters to the test.
I'm a bit disappointed in him, to be quite honest.
Wally Osborne is an independent who says he's voted for Van Drew since the 1990s.
I'm not necessarily in favor of the impeachment process. I just don't like the flip-flopping, you know, and it seemed to be like a move out of desperation.
Dan Scull says he, too, has always voted for Van Drew, even though he's a Republican. He says his support will not change.
You know, he cares about people and he calls everybody back. No matter what time of day, he calls everybody back.
Van Drew has a reputation for conservative stances, including votes against gay marriage, raising the minimum wage, and numerous gun control measures. Still, local Republicans view his party switch with skepticism. At least 2 Republicans who were already running for his seat say they intend to remain in the race. Van Drew is yet to formally declare himself a Republican, although an announcement is expected this week. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Pugliese.
Emergency crews in parts of the South are searching for survivors after dozens of suspected tornadoes raced through Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. 3 people are confirmed dead as a result. Ben Smith is a meteorologist at WHNT-TV in Tuntsville, Alabama. Welcome to Here and Now.
Well, Tanya, thank you for having me.
And Ben, how are things in Alabama right now?
Well, thankfully, things are much calmer after a very active night last night. We had a frontal boundary move on through, and temperatures have cooled off. We're actually in the 30s now, and the wind chills are in the 20s, so the weather is much improved.
We're hearing that there was a tornado on the ground for about 63 miles in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Which areas were hit the hardest?
Well, that was a big one. There were several in southern Mississippi, Louisiana. We've had multiple houses damaged, trees down, power lines down. The National Weather Service is actually out in 3 different areas now in North Alabama surveying the scene, and they will actually confirm, you know, if we had a tornado, and not only that, but how strong that tornado was. I think we probably had 3 here.
Wow. Yeah. You mentioned how things have quieted down. What is the main threat right now?
The main threat right now is just, well, here in North Alabama, we are prone to severe weather. I mean, we have 2 separate seasons. We have 1 in November and December, and then we have another one in March, April, May. And, you know, we're kind of used to it. So at this point, the public is just trying to clean up, trying to just get everything together and try to go back to a sense of normalcy here over the next few weeks. But obviously that's going to take some time because we have a lot of damage out there. Trees down, power lines down, houses. And we'll have even more information this afternoon once that weather service gets their information. And then we can actually confirm how strong those winds were from last night.
Yeah, you mentioned that there are 2 separate tornado seasons, November and then March and April. I mean, was this one uncharacteristic or par for the course on what you typically see in a given year?
That's an excellent question. And honestly, This was probably a little bit abnormal because it is December now. We're only a little over more of a week away from Christmas. So this is a little late for us to have a tornado. And to have one this strong, typically they're not as strong in the month of November, much less getting into December. Now, once we get into March, April, and May, then all bets are off. And we've had some monster tornadoes around here in April, April 27th. A lot of folks may remember that day. We had, there were like 96 tornado warnings issued that day for us, including an EF5. We had multiple EF5s across the Southeast. But for December, it's unusual.
Yeah, yeah. Ben Smith is a meteorologist at WHNT-TV in Huntsville, Alabama. Ben, thank you so much.
You're so very welcome.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
There are around 50,000 immigrants in jails around the country. Their next stop could be either a court or a one-way ticket out of the country. Our next guest has just written a book that argues against the mass detention of undocumented immigrants. It's called Migrating to Prison, America's Obsession with Locking Up Immigrants, and it's out this month. Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez is the author. He's an immigration lawyer who teaches law at the University of Denver. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jeremy.
Well, you say right at the beginning of the book that having permission to be here in the United States isn't necessarily a guarantee of freedom. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean that there are lots of people who have green cards. That is, they have permission to be in the United States, to live and work here as long as they like. And if for one reason or another they violate immigration law, or to be more accurate, the federal government thinks that they violated immigration law, they can find themselves locked up and put into the deportation process. And that doesn't matter. You don't get saved from that, you know, just because you have kids or because you served in the U.S. Army.
What do you mean the federal government thinks that they violated immigration law? Wouldn't it be a clear-cut situation?
No. The immigration law is far too complicated for any on-the-ground official to really have a clear sense of when it is that somebody is going to be deported. The reality is that there are lots of legal claims that people can make, but only if they have a lawyer. And the reality is that in immigration courts, there is no right to appointed counsel, which means that you get to have a lawyer by your side as you're making your last arguments to stay in the U.S., but only if you can pay for one.
Well, and when you say the people who are locked up as they're waiting for things to move through the legal process, how many people are we talking about?
Oh, we're talking in a given year, we're talking about anywhere from 400,000 to 500,000. This is true now under President Trump, but it's also true under President Obama. And I think this is an important part of the story that I'm trying to tell.
Well, and when you look back at the history of this, you point out in your book that in 1970, prosecutors charged only 575 people with an immigration crime. In 2013, that number was almost 98,000 people who were facing immigration charges. What happened?
Toward the end of the Bush administration, the federal government decided that they would take a hardline approach to people who are potentially violating immigration law. And the clearest way of doing that in the U.S. legal system is to throw people into the criminal justice system. So it's been a crime since 1929, in fact, to enter the United States without the government's permission or to do that after having previously been deported. But the reality was, as those figures evidence, that for most of that time, federal prosecutors didn't prioritize immigration law violations. They had bigger fish to fry, and that's how they were spending their limited resources. And that started to change toward the end of the George W. Bush administration. That continued under the 8 years of President Obama, and that certainly hasn't shifted gears under President Trump.
You say hasn't shifted gears under President Trump. Many would look at the situation now and say President Trump has taken a much harder line on immigrants than President Obama did.
I think when it comes to the number of people who are locked up, we see that under President Obama, we had more people inside immigration prisons than ever before in the history of the United States until President Trump. And so there certainly has been an increase, but I think that when we have one historical record surpass another historical record, we have to describe that as a trend, not as a parting of ways.
You have worked on a number of immigration cases. What are these immigration prisons like? How much access to them and to migrants in them did you have?
Well, as a lawyer, you certainly have a privileged access to these facilities. But the hard part is that many people inside these facilities don't have the money to hire a lawyer. So they're hoping to find somebody who's going to work for free, work pro bono. And certainly that does happen, but that does mean that the number of people who are going into these facilities is limited. When you do go into these facilities, what you realize is that they look a whole lot like a prison. And ICE, for example, likes to call them detention centers or service processing centers. But when you go through layers of barbed wire fencing, when you go through metal detectors, and when you go through, when there are steel doors that close shut behind you, it feels a whole lot like a prison. It looks a whole lot like a prison, and you can call it whatever you like. But for the folks who can't get out and who have a hard time finding people who are willing to come in, it certainly feels like they're in isolation in the way that most of us think prisons do.
Well, and in some cases, these are county jails that are housing migrants. In some cases, they're privately run, right?
That's correct. Actually, the majority of the facilities that the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency uses are county jails that are purporting to be nothing more than penal institutions.
Well, and some people might hear you say that and say, well, of course, that's where people who are breaking the law should be. You make the argument in this book that that's not the case.
Well, I don't think that we need to. I think anytime that we are contemplating locking up people, depriving them of their liberty, we have to ask why. What it is that we're trying to accomplish by doing that, and can we accomplish it equally well or better without depriving people of their liberty? And I think in this context in particular, there are some compelling reasons to suggest that locking up people doesn't actually promote the rule of law. It doesn't actually make any of us safer. And on the contrary, given the difficulties with accessing legal representation while locked up and going through the immigration court process, locking up people actually, I think, has the effect of subverting the legal process.
So what would you suggest?
I think that we should take the money that we're currently spending on immigration prisons. The ICE, for example, in 2017 spent $2.7 billion on its prison network. We should take that money and redirect it, direct it to paying for lawyers, direct it to paying for social workers who are going to make sure that people who are going through what is inherently a high stress process have some amount of stability in their lives, making sure that they understand the process, but also how to get there.
What do you say to people, though, who completely disagree with what you're saying and would say, why should we help people? Give them lawyers, give them psychologists, whatever the case may be, when really the message that should be sent to people who are coming into the country without documentation is you're not allowed to be here, go back home.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we're talking about a very diverse group of people, including people who have every right to be here under the law. We have a legal system that allows for people to come to the U.S. and claim asylum if they fear for their lives, if they're sent back to whatever country they're fleeing from. We have other folks who are locked up who have green cards. I spoke to a gentleman who whose name is Jerry Armijo, and he was born in Mexico, not far from where I was born in South Texas. We both went to school in South Texas public schools, and after high school, I went off to college, but he went off to the U.S. Army. He joined the Army and got sent to Iraq, and one day his tank got blown up. by an IED. And he got sent back to the U.S. and to South Texas, and he didn't get the care that he needed. And so he turned to self-medicating through drugs, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And eventually the police caught up with him. And my family's law firm eventually came across him through his parents because one day he just stopped showing up for court dates. And the reason was that ICE had picked him up and sent him into an immigration prison. So this is somebody who we trusted with literal tanks. This is somebody who volunteered to defend the United States, to put his life on the line and came very close to actually losing it. And then because of one bomb and a poor, an insufficient mental health care system and some bad decisions, he was locked up in an immigration prison and facing the possibility of deportation. So this is not a homogenous group that we could just talk about in broad terms. These are very complicated, contradictory individuals.
That brings me to one more point I want to get to with you, which is that President Trump, especially, but many people, including President Trump, have talked about the idea that there should really be a zero tolerance policy for undocumented immigrants when it comes to crimes that they commit. He has highlighted the crimes, violent crimes in some cases, that have been committed by undocumented immigrants. You say in this book that basically we need to hold undocumented immigrants to the exact same standard that we hold everybody else.
We need to hold immigrants, whether they're documented or not, to the very same standards that we hold people like me who were born into their citizenship. Jerry Armijo, he developed a criminal history because he messed up after going through some trauma in Iraq, defending the United States. His moral claim to the United States isn't weaker than mine is, simply because my mother happened to be in Texas when I was born and his mother happened to be about 10 miles south of where I was born. So this claim that some people are on worse footing or should be on worse footing because they happen to be born outside the United States, I think it takes a very narrow view of belonging in this community that we call the United States. All of us mess up, but it's not because we're U.S. citizens or not U.S. citizens. It's just because we're people. I would like to see an immigration law enforcement system that takes into account the fact that we're all fallible creatures. And if we're out looking for only the extraordinary migrants to welcome into our community, then I think we need to start by looking inward first and asking, you know, how extraordinary, how perfect are those of us who are making those requests?
That is Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez, whose new book is called Migrating to Prison: America's Obsession with Locking Up Immigrants. Cesar, thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Jeremy.
After more than 100 years without buffalo, one Native American tribe in Wyoming finally has its own herd again. But some members of the Northern Arapaho tribe aren't happy about the animal's return. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Maher reports.
The news that these 10 buffalo were on their way came as a last-minute surprise, but that didn't stop more than 100 tribal members from gathering to welcome them. The buffalo traveled hundreds of miles from a federally run bison range in Montana, so they're more than ready to thunder off the livestock trailer. Devin Oldman of the Northern Arapaho Historic Preservation Office says this moment is one of the proudest of his career.
When I'm 80 or 90 and only have a huge herd, I'm blessed by the Creator to live that long, and I have great-grandchildren or great-great-grandchildren. And I'll be able to see that reciprocity, you know, for the future.
Oldman says the Northern Arapaho have always been buffalo people, even after white colonization of the West drove the animals to the brink of extinction. Now that the tribe has a herd, Oldman says they can begin to reintroduce buffalo into their diets and their ceremonies. But getting them here was controversial, because in the buffalo's 131-year absence, the Northern Arapaho became something of a ranching tribe.
Jump on in. Just throw that over.
Ransom Logan is the manager of the Arapaho Ranch. As we drive a windy gravel road up into the mountains, where the tribe runs about 4,000 head of cattle, he tells me ranchers are worried about brucellosis, a bacterial disease that buffalo carry.
That's going to be a hard one to debate with ranchers, because they dang sure ain't going to want their livelihood infected by buffalo and having to quarantine and then essentially kill their whole cattle herd that they've worked their lifetime to get to, you know?
brucellosis causes cattle to abort their fetuses, though buffalo conservationists point out there's never been a documented case of brucellosis spreading from buffalo to cattle. But it's not just that. Logan says that not everyone in the tribe feels a connection to buffalo. When we step out of his truck to watch a group of grazing heifers, he tells me that being a cowboy is what makes him feel connected to his roots.
And I could see why they'd want to bring it back as far as the culture and understand where our tribe came from and how we lived, but the dang sure ought to be thought through pretty well, you know.
Another Arapaho rancher, Clorinda Calling Thunder, says that concern about brucellosis is the reason it's taken decades of back and forth to bring buffalo to northern Arapaho land. 10 years ago, the issue came to a tribal vote.
And one of our tribal members got up and said, "Oh no, we can't mix our cattle with the bison." And so the people just believed it, and so it was voted down.
Unlike most ranchers, Calling Thunder doesn't believe that buffalo pose any threat to her livelihood. Another thing that sets Calling Thunder apart, she's a third-generation cattle rancher who doesn't really care for beef. She hunts deer, elk, and yes, buffalo for sustenance. Some people have a hard time understanding that, but she sees no reason not to honor both Arapaho traditions, ranching cattle and hunting buffalo.
So I don't see where there should be a problem. I hope one of these days we have hundreds.
These 10 yearling buffalo are a start. Back at the brand new Northern Arapaho buffalo enclosure, as the crowd begins to thin out, the animals roam closer to the wire fence where Devin Oldman and his family are watching them. Oldman kneels to the ground and holds his two daughters close while he sings to the buffalo, welcoming them home. For Here and Now, I'm Savannah Marr.
The country is pretty divided when it comes to support for impeachment. A new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll finds 48% of the country opposes the impeachment of President Trump, while 47% supports it. Today, Americans on both sides of the issue are taking to the streets throughout the country as part of an organized effort to have their voices heard. We decided to check in with folks in Pennsylvania's 1st Congressional District in Bucks County, a swing district where presidential candidate Hillary Clinton narrowly won in 2016. It's also where Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick still holds a seat and is set to vote no on impeachment. Let's start our conversation with Kirsten Zulfo, a technical staffer at a law firm who is organizing today's protest for impeachment.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So you and other supporters of impeachment will be protesting in front of Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick's office. What do you hope these protests will accomplish?
We hope to convince Congressman Fitzpatrick to change the position that he has stated thus far and get him to vote yes on the articles of impeachment.
Do you feel that that is a realistic accomplishment based on what he has said and based on his stance and the pressure really from his colleagues to toe the party line?
I think on the obstruction of Congress article, it's something that we do have the opportunity to convince him. We need to remind him about the oath of office that he took, because in addition to being a congressman, he is a former FBI agent, the only one in Congress right now. So he's taken that oath of office to defend the Constitution many times in his career.
Tell me about who you'll be out there with.
Well, it looks like we're going to have several hundred people out rallying with us.
I heard it's cold.
So it is a bit cold and wet, though hopefully the rain will have stopped by the time we're meeting tonight at 5:30. But there are members of Indivisible. There are folks who are independents like myself. There are Democrats. There are Republicans who turn out for these events because it isn't just about party identification. It's about people who want to stand up for what our nation is supposed to stand for. This is about defending democracy.
Have you been watching the hearings?
I have been. Well, I should say I've been listening to the hearings while I'm at work.
Yeah, you've been listening to the hearings. And what's been the chatter, the talk among your coworkers, your family?
I would say that what I am hearing is that people are fairly happy with the way that Democrats have presented the situation, that some of what we're hearing sounds like a bit of grandstanding, and there's an awful lot of procedural complaints from the Republicans, but no real defense of the president's actions. So that has made for a sometimes frustrating listen.
I mentioned that polls show the country is pretty evenly split for and against impeachment. Is that discouraging for you?
Not particularly. Having seen so many different polls with different numbers, it's something that you kind of tune out a little bit.
Yeah, at the same time, though, even if it's 47 or 48 or 50, it really is split down the middle where people feel very strongly one way or the other. How do you reconcile with the idea that there are people in this country who see things two different ways?
It is a difficult thing to reconcile. I know that people tend to retreat into their corners and they choose the media sources that that best reflect the opinions that they already hold. So that is a somewhat discouraging situation. But I think that if people actually decide to read the original sources, that it's pretty clear that that President Trump withheld vital congressionally approved aid to force a foreign country to serve his political whims. And from where I sit, I feel like they're misinformed. Hopefully some of them out there today, because I know they're meeting in the same location that we've had our rally planned for several months. hopefully some of them will hear a bit of what we say today, and maybe it will strike home a little bit.
That's Kirsten Zolfo, an organizer of today's protest in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, is part of a nationwide protest calling for impeachment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Jim Worthington, who is the owner of two athletic clubs in Pennsylvania, including the Newtown Athletic Club. He's also the founder of People for Trump and a member of the President's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition. Welcome to Here Now.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
So, Jim, these demonstrations will be happening throughout the country, including Bucks County, where you are. As I mentioned, you are a Trump supporter. You're against impeachment. Tell us some of the reasons why.
Well, first of all, I think it's been 3 years of and longer of trying to just find something to hang their hat on to cause problems. I mean, the Russian investigation lasted for 2 years. It was a nothing burger. Now you come up with this where they're talking about holding back monies to the Ukraine for, what, two and a half months? I mean, you know, I've read the testimony of the call. I don't think it's anywhere near a quid pro quo. I mean, you've got the Ukrainian president that said that it wasn't such a thing. I mean, if you really want the answer, ask the guy who was on the other end of the phone. So to me, it's just another thing. And I mean, how many Democratic representatives have come out and said all along the way that they're going to continue to try to find things, countless others that have made it clear that they're there just to find a way to make it difficult on the president and have him try to get him out of office through impeachment because they know they can't beat him in 2020.
Jim, what's been the chatter in your home at your athletic clubs with the folks that you know that you guys have been talking about regarding this impeachment inquiry?
You know what? Surprisingly, it's been a non-event. I mean, I have 12,000 members of my club, 3,000 people come in a day. Very few people bring it up. I don't think it's playing well on Main Street. I think people are bored with it. When you have 3,000 customers come in your facility a day, you have an opportunity to speak to them at length about any number of things. And very few people even bring it up. I mean, even in our fitness center where you've got 9 TVs on and, you know, you got Fox, CNN, and MSNBC on, and nobody's even, it's not like anybody's pointing at the TV talking about this. I think it's people are bored with it. I think they've maybe the extremes on both sides are into it. But, you know, everyday Americans are happy with their life. They're worried about the holidays. They're happy with the fact that the economy's doing well. And it's a big non-event. So I don't think it's playing well in the heartland. And I know it's not playing well here in suburban Pennsylvania. Just people just don't have an interest in it.
Are you planning counter demonstrations?
Yeah, you know what's funny? We are only because, we didn't look. The Republicans aren't out there trying to make a scene. We didn't when this came up. It was just Sunday night when I heard about this planned demonstration in front of our Congressman Fitzpatrick's office. So it was decided. Well, we're going to, you know, go out and, you know, have a few people go out there and show support. But we're not look, if they have 1,000 people, if we get 50 or 25 or 100, we're not looking to make a statement. We're there
but
to show support.
You don't think that that signifies the support for the president
no,
or support
not
for
at
impeachment
all.
Based on the
working.
Numbers out there?
No, we're all at work. We're getting on with our lives. We believe that the president has nothing to be concerned about. We also know that, you know, this House, you know, even though Nancy Pelosi said that she wouldn't do anything unless it was bipartisan, which turned out to be a lie. The fact of the matter is there isn't bipartisan and, you know, it's just party lines and, you know, it's going nowhere in the Senate. So people are more interested again in their lives, what's going on. And frankly, they're really interested in, and I have my own PAC, People for America. It's just drumming up more support from Republicans for the president. So in that case, you know, when this vote occurs on Wednesday, since they've gone this far, I hope they do vote to impeach. I am praying that they vote to impeach, because that's just going to rally the support for the president even more so. I'm finding that my group,
you're looking directly to 2020 and the election at this point.
We're focused on winning the election in 2020 in November. And the only thing this is doing is galvanizing the president's support. It's never the people that I know are more enthused now than they were in 2016.
Jim Worthington, founder of People for Trump and member of the President's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition. Jim, thanks for taking the time.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Tanya, did you know there are just 2 weeks left until the new year?
I'm not ready. Yes, I did know that.
Well, and the end of the decade. But here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, already has made a resolution for 2020. She wants to go greener in the kitchen. And just in time for holiday shopping, she joins us with some suggestions for items that can help. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there.
So I actually think about this all the time. And one thing I did was I stopped using Ziploc bags and switched to storing leftover food in any kind of glass containers.
Excellent.
What about you? How can you be more environmentally conscious?
I'll tell
in
you
the
something.
Kitchen?
I cook every day. I'm constantly testing recipes, cooking meals, and I go through so much plastic. And my youngest daughter, Emma, was home a few months ago, and she looked in my refrigerator and she's like, "Mom, this has got to stop." So she sent me something called Stasher. These are plastic-free, reusable storage bags. This is a great alternative to any plastic product, but it's also a great alternative to the glass things. These are made from silicone. They can be used for everything. You can cook in them. You can throw them in your dishwasher. You can store pretzels or half an onion or half a lemon. CEO and founder is a woman named Kat Nouri, and she was determined to prevent millions of single-use plastics from piling up in landfills and polluting the ocean. And they come in all these great sizes and shapes and colors, and they have this cool, tight thing when you put it together, so it really seals food in.
And you can cook with these.
Yeah, that's what it says. Yeah.
I started using them after you sent them to us, and I can say they're really nice. Like Jeremy, I said I wasn't going to use those little sandwich bags anymore, but they do work because they're stackable. You know, they don't take up a lot of room.
You know, it sounds silly, like, oh, I'm going to avoid plastics as much as possible. Like, that shouldn't be that hard, but you're undoing years of patterns. So another great product for doing that is something called Beeswrap.
This smells really good.
Well, you know what you're smelling is? So this was begun by a woman, they're all women, a Vermonter named Sarah Kack, I believe you pronounce it, mother of three, gardener, farmer, and in her quest to eliminate plastics, she started to infuse organic cotton with beeswax, jojoba oil, and tree resin. And so they stretch. Feel those,
I'm trying
guys.
To put it over like a coffee cup here.
Go ahead. It'll mold on. Now make a tight, there you go. It makes
look
a tight
at that.
Seal.
It's working for you.
It's really, I mean, not only is it cool, but it's really comes in all these kind of very pretty colorables. It's completely reusable. And as I said, I've done half an onion in there, raw meat, snacks, leftovers. Another great way to get off the plastic wheel.
Called Beeswrap.
Yeah, B-E-E.
Kathy, You also have a vegetable peeler here. How does that fit into your
idea? Yeah, so that's a little bit different. This is a wide mouth vegetable peeler, and I like to use it because you end up wasting less on the vegetable. So if you're peeling a parsnip or a carrot, it's going to come off much faster. You can also make spirals. You can thinly slice root vegetables and get these wonderful spirals that you can steam or add to soups. You can peel ginger with it and waste a lot less. So the amount of vegetable waste is minimized. And the bonus is you can keep all these vegetable peelings, the onion skins, the carrot shavings, put them in your freezer, and then use it all to make a recycled vegetable stock.
Or you could compost some of that stuff.
Right,
indeed you can, but not both at the same time.
So actually, speaking of vegetable peeler, I just ordered a coffee maker, one of those pod machines, they, in order to show you that you could recycle the pods, they sent you a vegetable peeler made out of the recycled
Cool, because that's my problem with those coffee pods is that it seems hugely wasteful.
Yes.
Yeah. We've got a whole bunch of ideas. Cheese storage bags that are not plastic that allow the cheese to breathe and stay fresher longer. They're made in France. They almost look like wax bags.
And then the salad sling. The salad sling is so cool.
It almost looks like those things people put their babies in. So it's a three-layered design that features an ultra-absorbent microfiber and a waterproof barrier. You put your wet greens in the middle. So
it's like a towel.
It's like a super thick terry cloth towel. So you put your herbs that you've washed or your kale or your Swiss chard, put it in the middle, you close it up, and you swing it round and round. It's a good workout for your arms. And the centrifugal force dries the greens in seconds. You can get rid of that massive, awkward, plastic salad spinner you've had in your drawer for 2 years that takes up half your kitchen.
Or half of your Lazy Susan.
There you go. There you go. So that's another
great expensive?
One.
I think that's one of the
You
questions.
You know what? Let's go through them, actually. The Beeswrap ranges from $19 to $42 for a pack of several of them. They last over and over and over again. Think about how much you spend on plastic wrap and foil and bags. Get rid of all of that. You buy these stashers and these Beeswraps, maybe about $20-$30, and you're saving money. The vegetable peeler is about $3. The salad sling is really reasonable. It's $20.
Wow. So some good ideas for the holidays as we get ready for a greener new year in the kitchen.
We've
got all these items at hereandnow.org. The whole list from Kathy Gunst, Here and Now resident chef. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
For only the fourth time in history, the House of Representatives gets set to vote on articles of impeachment against a president.
The vote is expected to fall largely along party lines, with Democrats voting to approve and Republicans standing by the president.
We'll have that and the rest of the day's news next time on Here and Now.